Good evening. My name is Fred Neuhauser. I'm the chair of the philosophy department here at Barnard. And I'm very happy to welcome you tonight to Barnard College and to this lecture by Noam Chomsky, sponsored by the Center for Palestine Studies at Columbia University. The last time I heard Professor Chomsky speak was in the mid-80s when I was a graduate student here. And if I remember correctly, the talk was held in this very same room. It's a little bit depressing for me to think that his talk that evening, almost 30 years ago, could have borne the same title that his talk has tonight, which, as you already know, is America and Israel-Palestine, War and Peace. Among other topics, Professor Chomsky will address how the United States' strategic alliance with Israel affects the process of peace in the Middle East, and why the U.S. is so involved in that region in the first place. Our time tonight is very limited, and for that reason, I'm going to forego a long introduction. We'll start right off with Professor Chomsky's lecture, which will last perhaps 40 minutes, and that should leave us about 40 minutes after that for questions and answers. Before I turn the podium over to him, I'd like to just mention and recommend to you one of his most recent books that's directly relevant to the topic tonight. This book, which is co-authored with Ilan Pape, is called Gaza in Crisis: Reflections on Israel's War Against the Palestinians. It's published by Haymarket Books, and they're at the back of the room and have plenty of copies of that book and other books for sale if you'd like to pick one up after the lecture. I think we'll just move right into Professor Chomsky's lecture. I'm very honored to present to you Professor Noam Chomsky.
Actually, I didn't pick the title for that book. If I had, I would have called it the U.S. War Against the Palestinians, which I think is more significant, certainly for us. Well, a good place to start this discussion is a useful concept that I'll borrow from a British diplomat, a young British diplomatic historian, Mark Curtis, in his important and I might add, therefore, neglected works on post-World War II British crimes, of which there are many. He makes a distinction between people and what he calls unpeople. Unpeople are those who sort of look human, but are not considered worthy of elementary human rights. And that happens to be a very crucial distinction for this topic. Come to it soon. But just first notice that the distinction is ever present. About a week ago, the New York Times had a headline saying, "The West celebrates a cleric's death." The cleric was Awlaki, killed by a drone. It wasn't just death, it was assassination. And another step forward in Obama's global assassination campaign, which actually breaks some new records in international terrorism. Well, it's not true that everyone in the West celebrated. There were some critics. Almost all of the critics, of whom there weren't many, criticized the action or qualified it because of the fact that Awlaki was an American citizen. That is, he was a person. Unlike suspects who are intentionally murdered or collateral damage, meaning we treat them kind of like the ants we step on when we walk down the street. They're not American citizens, so they are unpeople, and therefore they can be freely murdered. It's some may remember, if you have good memories, that there used to be a concept in Anglo-American law called a presumption of innocence, innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Now, that's so deep in history that there's no point even bringing it up, but it did once exist. Some of the critics brought up the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, which says that no person, notice, shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Well, of course, that was never intended to apply to persons, so it wasn't intended to apply to unpeople. And unpeople fall into several categories. There's, first of all, the indigenous population, either in the territories already held or those that were expected to be conquered soon. It didn't apply to them. And of course, it didn't apply to those who the Constitution declared to be three-fifths human, so therefore unpeople. That latter category was transferred into theoretically into the category of people by the 14th Amendment, essentially the same wording as the Fifth Amendment in this respect, but now a person was intended to hold of freed slaves. That was in theory. In practice, it barely happened. After about 10 years, the category of three-fifths human were returned to category of unpeople by the device of criminalization of black life, which essentially restored slavery, maybe something even worse than slavery, actually went on until the Second World War. And it's being reinstituted now, past 30 years of severe moral and social regression in the United States. Well, the 14th Amendment was recognized right away to be problematic. The concept of person was both too narrow and too broad. And the courts went to work to overcome both of those flaws. The concept of person was expanded to include legal fictions created and sustained by the state, what's called corporations. And it was also narrowed over the years to exclude undocumented aliens. That goes right up to the present, to recent Supreme Court cases, which make it clear that corporations not only are persons, but they're persons with rights far beyond those of persons of flesh and blood, so kind of super persons. The mislabeled free trade agreements give them astonishing rights, and of course the court has added more. But the crucial need to make sure that the category of unpeople includes those who escaped from the horrors we've created in Central America and Mexico, try to get here. Those are not persons, they are unpeople. And of course it includes any foreigners, especially those accused of terror, which is a concept that has taken quite an interesting conceptual change, an interesting one, since 1981, when Ronald Reagan came into office and declared the global war on terror, what's called a GWAT in current fancy terminology. I won't go into that here, except with a comment to note on how the term is now used without any raising even any notice. So take, for example, Omar Khadr. He's a 15-year-old child, Canadian. He was accused of a very severe crime, namely trying to defend his village in Afghanistan from U.S. invaders. Obviously, that's severe crime, serious terrorist, so he was sent first to secret prison in Bagram, then off to Guantanamo for 8 years. After 8 years, he pleaded guilty to some charges. We all know what that means. If you want, pick up a few of the details, even in Wikipedia, more in other sources. So he pleaded guilty and was given 8 more years a sentence. He would have gotten 30 more years if he hadn't pleaded guilty. After all, it is a severe crime, defending your village from American aggressors. He's Canadian, so Canada could have him extradited, but with typical courage, they refused. They don't want to offend the master, understandably. Well, the crime of resisting aggression, it's not a new category of terrorism. There may be some of you old enough to remember the slogan, terror against terror, which was used by the Gestapo and which we've taken over. None of this arouses any interest because all of these victims belong to the category of unpeople. Well, that coming back to our topic now, the concept of unpeople is central to tonight's topic. Israeli Jews are people. Palestinians are unpeople. And a lot follows from that. There's clear illustrations constantly. So here's a clipping, if I remember to bring it, from the New York Times. Front page story, Wednesday, October 12th. The lead story is, deal with Hamas will free Israeli held since 2006. It's Gilad Shalit. And right next to it is running right across the top of the front page is a picture of four women kind of agonized over the fate of Gilad Shalit. Friends and supporters of the family of Staff Sergeant Gilad Shalit received word of the deal at the family's protest tent in Jerusalem. Well, that's understandable, actually. I think he should have been released a long time ago. But there's something missing from this whole story. So, like, there's no pictures of Palestinian women, and no discussion, in fact, in the story of what about the Palestinian prisoners being released? Where do they come from? And there's a lot to say about that. So, for example, we don't know, at least I don't read it in the Times, whether the release includes the elected Palestinian officials who were kidnapped and imprisoned by Israel in 2007 when the United States, the European Union, and Israel decided to dissolve the only freely elected legislature in the Arab world. That's called democracy promotion, technically, in case you're not familiar with the term. So I don't know what happened to them. There are also other people who've been in prison exactly as long as Gilad Shalit, in fact, one day longer. The day before Gilad Shalit was captured at the border, Israeli troops entered Gaza, kidnapped two brothers, the Muammar brothers, spirited them across the border in violation of the Geneva Conventions, of course, and they've disappeared into Israel's prison system. I haven't a clue what happened to them. I've never seen a word about it. And as far as I know, nobody cares, which makes sense, after all, unpeople. Whatever you think about capturing a soldier from an attacking army, plainly kidnapping civilians is a far more severe crime, but that's only if they're people. In this case, it really doesn't matter. It's not that it's unknown. So if you look back at the press the day after the Muammar brothers were captured, there's a couple of lines here and there, but it's just insignificant, of course. Which makes some sense, because there are lots of others in prison, thousands of them, many without charges. There's also, in addition to this, the secret prison system, like Facility 1391, if you want to look it up on the internet, secret prison, which means, of course, a torture chamber in Israel, which actually was reported pretty well in Israel when it was discovered, also reported in England and in Europe, but I haven't seen a word about it here, at least anywhere that anybody's likely to look. I've written about it, and a couple of others. All of this is, these are all unpeople, so naturally nobody cares. In fact, the racism is so profound that it's kind of like the air we breathe. We're unaware of it, you know, just pervades everything. Coming to the title of this talk, it could mislead, and it could be misinterpreted as supporting a kind of conventional picture of the negotiations, such as they are, United States on over here, and then these two recalcitrant forces over there. The United States is an honest broker trying to bring together the two militant, difficult groups that don't seem to be able to get along with one another. Now that's that is the standard version, but it's totally false. I mean, if there were serious negotiations, they would be organized by some neutral party, maybe Brazil. And on one side, you'd have the U.S. and Israel. On the other side, you'd have the world. That's literally true. But that's one of those things that's unspeakable. Although it's very clear, if you look at the record, I'll just give a few of the high points, or maybe low points, which illustrate this much richer record. So let's go back 40 years, in 1971. In 1971, the U.S. and Israel made one of their most important decisions. It had a lot of consequences. Egypt offered Israel a full peace treaty in return for withdrawal from the territories, and all they cared about was, all Sadat cared about was Egyptian territory, the Sinai. At that time, Israel was beginning to implement major plans for settlement in the Egyptian Sinai. It was going to be a new city, Amit, supposedly 1 million people, Jewish, of course, settlements, kibbutzim, others. They were driving thousands of peasants, Bedouin, into the desert, destroying towns, and mosques, cemeteries, on and on. And they had a choice. Incidentally, this offer by Sadat said absolutely nothing about the Palestinians. He also regarded them as unpeople. So there was a few phrases about refugees, which didn't mean anything, but nothing about Palestinian rights. Israel considered the offer and decided to reject it, saying they would not retreat to the 67 borders, the internationally recognized border. Jordan made a similar proposal shortly after. I don't think that one was even answered. The crucial question always is, what's the master going to do? And in fact, if you go to Washington, there was an internal debate over it. There was a split in the government. William Rogers, Secretary of State, and the State Department were apparently in favor of accepting Sadat's offer. Incidentally, we don't have a good documentary record from this period, so it has to be kind of pieced together. But so it looks as though Rogers was in favor of it. It was pretty much like his own proposals. Henry Kissinger at the time was trying hard to displace, he was National Security Advisor, to displace the State Department. I think the State Department was his biggest enemy in the world. I mean, way down below somewhere was Russia and somebody else. But if the State Department said it was raining, he would tell Nixon the sun's shining. And this went on until he finally kicked out Rogers and took over. Well, since Rogers was in favor of it, Kissinger was, of course, against it. And he explains it. If you read his memoirs, he says he was in favor of what he calls stalemate, meaning no negotiations, just force. And it's kind of understandable to a person who believes in nothing but force, what's called a realist in international relations theory. It looked as though Israel had all the force. If you read the internal record from Israel at the time, which is quite interesting, the line was, Arabs don't know which end of the gun to hold, you know, we can do anything we like, so why bother? So Kissinger went along with the Israeli rejection and rejection of the Jordanian proposal, which turned out to be quite significant. Sadat kept trying to convince the U.S. to accept his offer to become basically a satellite. He kicked out the Russians, did everything he could, made it very clear that if Israel continues to build in the Sinai, there'd be war. Yamit was the name of the town, Yamit city, in fact, Yamit means war, he said. But nobody paid any attention. You know, Arabs don't know which end of the gun to hold. Then came the 1973 war. Turned out they did know which end of the gun to hold. In fact, it was a very close thing for Israel. They barely survived. It was last minute shipments of arms kind of saved them. And they understood this a problem. The Kissinger understood too. He does understand force. I don't know if he understands anything else, but he recognized that Arabs just can't be disregarded. Then starts the famous shuttle diplomacy, leading to a Nobel Prize for Peace. And finally, in 1979, the Camp David agreements, in which, in effect, the U.S. and Israel accepted Sadat's 1971 offer, except that they accepted it in, from their point of view, a harsher form, because by the 70s, the issue of Palestinian national rights had kind of entered international agenda. So they were at least compelled to make some gestures towards Palestinian national rights. This is regarded as a diplomatic triumph in American diplomatic history, great triumph of Carter and Kissinger. It's actually a diplomatic catastrophe. By refusing to accept peace when it was offered, they opened the way to a very significant war, which incidentally came pretty close to being a nuclear war, but barely managed to escape and finally accepted what they'd rejected in 1971, though in a harsher form. Well, that's 1971. Meanwhile, other things had happened. As I mentioned, the Palestinian issue of national rights began to appear by the mid-70s, and in 1976, there came another critical event, also wiped out of history. You can find it if you really search, but sort of politically incorrect, so not noticed. In January 1976, the three major Arab states, so-called confrontation states, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, brought to the Security Council a resolution calling for a two-state settlement. That was the first official international reference to the notion of a Palestinian state, a two-state settlement on the international border, internationally recognized border, pre-June 67, with guarantees for the right of every state in the region, Israel and Palestine, to exist in peace and security within secure and recognized boundaries. That soon became an overwhelming international consensus. By now, virtually everybody accepts it, in fact, have for a long time. Israel reacted, refused to attend the session. It reacted by bombing Lebanon with no pretext, killing about 50 people. Presumably that was a reaction to the UN meeting. The United States reacted more politely, namely by vetoing the resolution. That continued to happen. I won't run through the whole story, but it's been pretty much the record ever since at the General Assembly. Well, I'll skip forward till 1988. In 1988, the Palestinian National Council formally accepted essentially this framework. They'd tacitly accepted it before. So a two-state settlement, rights of every state in the region, to exist in peace and security, and so on and so forth. Israel and the United States immediately reacted. Israel reacted with a formal declaration that there can be no additional Palestinian state between Israel and Jordan. They declared that Jordan is a Palestinian state. The Jordanians don't think so, and Palestinians don't think so, but remember, they're unpeople, so it doesn't matter. So there can't be another Palestinian state. And added that the fate of the territories would have to be determined according to the guidelines of the State of Israel. That was essentially a coalition government at the time, Labor, Likud, Peres, Shamir. You know, again, as always, the question is how the United States will react. And the United States reacted at once in what's called the Baker Plan, December 1989. The Baker Plan essentially just repeated the Israeli formal declaration. So no additional Palestinian state between Jordan and Israel, and fate of the territories settled according to the guidelines of the State of Israel. Well, a little bit later came the famous Oslo agreements, a couple years later. The Oslo agreements were heralded as a fabulous breakthrough in the struggle for peace. Rabin and Arafat met on the White House lawn with Clinton holding him under his arms, and Rabin reluctantly shook hands, looking the other direction, and they issued a Declaration of Principles. If you read the Declaration of Principles, it's very short, about 2 pages, you can see exactly what it meant. It was a total capitulation, 100%. The Declaration of Principles states that the final outcome of negotiations will be based on UN 242. Now, anyone who knows anything about this story knows that UN 242 says nothing about the Palestinians except refugees. So if that's the final outcome, Palestinians have given up. And that was understood. Ed Said criticized it. I criticized it. A couple of other people. But the most important was Haider al-Abashafi. He was the conservative nationalist, who's probably the most respected person in the territories. And he had, in fact, been heading the negotiations team within the Madrid framework. He rejected it right away. In fact, he refused even to attend the Day of Awe on the White House lawn, and for very simple reasons, exactly what I said. He says this just gives up any hope of national self-determination. And furthermore, he added and stressed, it says nothing about continuing settlement. If Israel continues its settlement programs, then game's over. So he refused to attend. He's a person of principle. One reason he was so respected, but there was a lot of unfortunate euphoria about it. Well, meanwhile, the settlements continued right through the 90s. You look at the pace of settlement under Clinton, steady increase, peaked actually in the year 2000 with a sharp increase. Also, the US and Israel put into operation at that time a very significant program. Early 90s, they put into operation a program to separate Gaza from the West Bank. Now, that happens to be in direct violation of the specific terms of the Oslo Accords, which says they're a territorial unity which can't be broken. But remember, we're talking about international outlaws, the United States and Israel, so they do what they like, and subordinate educated classes, they can get away with it. So they immediately began to separate Gaza from the West Bank. That's been persisting since. And that's quite important because it means that if any kind of national rights are ever granted to whatever fragments remain in the West Bank, they'll be imprisoned. They'll be imprisoned between Israel and Jordan, Jordanian dictatorship. They'll have no outlet to the outside world, which would have to be Gaza. Of course, they also lose a very important part of Palestinian territory. And that, again, continues until today in pretty ugly ways. Well, I should mention that the settlements are not only illegal, but recognized to be illegal. There's really no debate about this. The Security Council, the International Court of Justice, the United States used to recognize them as illegal too when it was more or less part of the world, and now it says they're disputed or something, so the press says disputed. Israel recognized that they were illegal right away. In late 1967, when the settlements began, Israel's leading a legal advisor, well-known international lawyer, Theodore Meyron, now quite a distinguished international legal figure, he advised the government that any settlements at all are in violation of the Geneva Conventions, which says very explicitly you can't transfer population to occupied territory. It's a war crime. So that's the Israeli Attorney General agreed with that. He informed the government of the same thing. And perhaps the most interesting reaction was Moshe Dayan. He's kind of one at the more dovish end of the spectrum, and a person who did have some sympathy for the rights of Palestinians. And he was in charge of the occupied territories, Minister of Defense. He said, yeah, it's true, it's in violation of international law, but countries violate international law, so we'll do it too. And as long as the boss says it's okay, it doesn't matter what international law is. He also gave a kind of a poetic image to explain what's happening. He said, it's a little bit like Bedouin customs. I mean, a Bedouin will kidnap some young girl and rape her and force her to marry him. And ultimately, she'll kind of accept it, and maybe she'll even think it's a great thing. And that's what will happen with the Palestinians. He added, we'll inform the Palestinians that we have nothing for you. You shall live like dogs, and whoever wants to leave can leave, and we'll see where this leads. Meanwhile, we'll continue settlement, and the goal is to have permanent rule over the territories. That's at the dovish end. So there's no real debate about this, and anything involving what's called Jerusalem, Jerusalem incidentally is a huge territory, about five times the size of Jerusalem, annexed by Israel. Anything involving Jerusalem is doubly illegal, because it's in violation of specific Security Council resolutions relating to Jerusalem. In fact, some of those were even signed on to by the United States in the early days when it was still part of the world. Well, I won't go through the rest of the record, just to say that there's been one interesting break in the record of total rejectionism on the part of the U.S. and Israel. Now, that was in December 2000, Clinton's last month in office. Clinton recognized that the proposals in the failed Camp David agreements couldn't be accepted by any Palestinian, any Arab, and he therefore gave a different, presented a different framework. It was called his parameters. They were kind of vague, but more forthcoming. He then made a speech saying both Israel and the Palestinians accepted the parameters, that both sides had reservations. And they met in Taba, Egypt, both sides, in January 2001, and tried to hash out their differences. And we actually have a good record of this, a lot of it in English, a lot more in Hebrew. And they basically converged. They were getting pretty close. In fact, in their last press conference, both sides said that with a little more time, they might settle everything. Well, the negotiations were broken off at that time by Israel, Prime Minister Barak, and since then there's been no formal negotiations. Well, that tells us something. It tells us that if an American president is just willing to let diplomacy proceed, it might actually implement the international consensus, which I'll stress again is almost exceptionless. Well, this continued. A couple of years later, the quartet was formed, US, Europe, Russia, and the UN, and they issued what's called a roadmap. It's called Bush's roadmap, which everyone is supposed to live up to. Hamas is constantly denounced because it doesn't accept the roadmap. Less noticed is that Israel immediately rejected the roadmap. It formally accepted it, but added 14 reservations, which, when you read them, completely eliminate its content. Now, this was kept pretty quiet. It came out in public, apart from activists, for the first time in Jimmy Carter's book, the famous book, about peace and apartheid. Now, the book was roundly condemned all over the place, but I never saw one mention of the fact that his book was the first one that reviewed publicly for a mainstream audience the Israeli reservations, which effectively rejected the roadmap. Well, that's that. Then the next major event was the 2006 elections. The U.S. basically promoted them, tried hard to get their own candidate elected, Abbas, but he lost. These were free elections, first ones in the Arab world, carefully monitored, recognized to be free and fair, but they had a flaw. The wrong side won. We have a concept of democracy which says it's okay as long as our candidates win, but if anything else happens, no, it's not democracy. So instantly, within days, the U.S. and Israel instituted programs to punish the Palestinians severely for the crime of voting the wrong way in a free election. And Europe toddled along, as it usually does, also joining in the punishment. Well, that was 2006, and then starts the Gaza. The Gaza horror story had been awful enough for years, but kind of escalated then. In the next year, in the summer of 2007, the U.S. instantly, right after the elections, also began a standard policy. If you don't like a government, let's organize a military coup. So they began to organize a military coup led by a Fatah strongman, Mohammed Dahlan. Hamas preempted the coup attempt. It was a fierce battle in Gaza, and Hamas essentially won the battle. Now, that led to much more severe sanctions. I mean, it's bad enough to vote the wrong way in a free election. It's worse to block a military coup intended to overthrow the elected government. And then things got a lot worse. In the next summer, July 2008, Hamas and Israel reached a truce. Hamas lived up to the truce. Israel officially recognizes that during the truce, not a single Hamas rocket was fired. That's despite the fact that Israel didn't observe the truce. Israel did not. Part of the terms were that Israel would end the siege of Gaza, which is, of course, an act of war. And they didn't, and they had a reason. The reason is Gilad Shalit hadn't been released. Remember, he's a person, unlike the thousands in Israeli jails, many of them without charge. So therefore, they didn't accept it, but nevertheless, Hamas lived up to it. On November 4th, under the cover of the U.S. election, Israel invaded Gaza on a completely phony pretext, killed half a dozen Hamas activists, and then rockets started firing. As usual, all the casualties were Palestinian, 100%. Late December, Hamas offered to renew the truce. Israel considered it, rejected it, decided instead to invade. That's Operation Cast Lead, December 27th. They're really shocking war crimes. I won't say anything about them. They're pretty well covered. There's a book by Norman Finkelstein, which is kind of a pretty definitive study of what happened. But there's also a very revealing book by, which I don't think is, I'm sure it's been published here, by two Norwegian doctors, Mats Gilbert and Erik Fosse, who, amazing people. They were working in the main hospital, the Al-Shifa Hospital, right through this whole horror story. And they just give a very gripping account. I mean, I couldn't put it down once I started reading it, which just goes kind of day by day, the horrors that were happening there. I certainly urge everyone to read it, even if you don't learn new facts. It gives you a picture that's, you know, that the international reports don't quite convey. Well, meanwhile, the U.S. blocked the ceasefire, usual action. Now, this is after Obama had been elected, before he came into office, and he was asked, of course, if he had anything to say about these massive war crimes, and he had an answer. He said, there's only one president And I'm not the president yet, so I can't say anything. He was saying things about everything else, but not that. Actually, his campaign did say something. They released a statement of his saying that if his daughters were under attack by rockets, he would do anything to stop them. He's referring to Israeli people in Sderot, you know, a town nearby, not the ones who are being subjected to what Fasse and Gilbert call infanticide. And the term is accurate. If you read your book, you'll see why it was infanticide, miserable, violent infanticide. But they're unpeople, so Obama had nothing to say about them. The operation was very carefully calibrated so that it would end almost moments before Obama's inauguration, so then he could come up with the famous next statement that applies to everything. Let's not look backward, let's look forward. That's a wonderful slogan for the people who are holding the clubs on every topic, and Obama uses it all the time. Well, the next thing that happened is that Obama gave his first major speech on this topic. A couple days later, announced the appointment of George Mitchell as negotiator, which makes sense, sensible appointment, except for what he added. He added that Mitchell isn't going to have any powers. And he made that very clear. It took genius to miss it, but it was missed. He welcomed the Arab peace plan. There was an Arab peace plan which had been around and the U.S. had rejected it. The Arab peace plan goes beyond the international consensus and calls for normalization of relations with Israel after a two-state settlement is established. And Obama said that it's very good that the Arabs are doing this. They ought to now implement their plan by normalizing relations with Israel. He's literate, you know. He knows perfectly well that that was not the plan. So do the journalists who pretended not to see what he was saying. He omitted totally the condition, namely two-state settlement, not a word about that, and just said, yeah, go ahead and normalize relations. That's a way of telling the world, I'm not going to do anything. And in fact, that continues. On Israel-Palestine, he probably has the worst record of any president. I won't go on with the details. It continues. Last February came another major step. Obama vetoed a Security Council resolution. That's normal. I mean, dozens of them. But this one was particularly interesting. It even got some press because Obama was vetoing a resolution which called for the implementation of official U.S. policy, namely stop the settlement expansion, which is, of course, criminal. So he vetoed it, and you know, the State Department had to issue complicated explanations. But he just became a laughingstock at that point. By now, Obama has actually made a major achievement. He succeeded in reaching a level of unpopularity in the Arab world, which is even higher than Bush, and that takes some doing. Bush, I think, had about 9% support. I think Obama's down to about 5 or something. And he's mainly an object of ridicule with this continual humiliation of himself and, of course, of the country. Israel, they just ridicule him with some reason. Meanwhile, settlements continue, and perfectly brazenly. In fact, after Obama's veto, Israel quite correctly took that to be, you know, a green light saying, do anything you like. So they, in fact, they already knew it, but this finished it. In fact, it's utterly brazen. Just the last couple of days, Israel's announced a couple of thousand new housing units in what they call Givat HaMatos. That's a settlement, a new settlement, in between Bethlehem and Jerusalem, East Jerusalem. If you look at those two cities there, you can see one from the other. And Israel's been gradually surrounding Jerusalem with, you know, expanded Jerusalem with illegal settlements, and this kind of closes the ring. It means that the people in Bethlehem can see Jerusalem, but if they want to get there, you know, maybe they go through Cyprus or something like that. But, and that's done perfectly brazenly, you know, read it in the newspaper, small column, and they know they can do whatever they like. At least, well, Obama will just genuflect, in fact, humiliate himself as he's been doing pretty impressively. It's actually interesting to compare him with former presidents. So Bush number one had a little self-respect when Israel was brazenly insulting the United States by announcing a settlement expansion the day in which James Baker, you know, patrician Secretary of State, showed up. The Bush administration sort of punished them. In fact, Baker was furious, and he told the Israeli government he'd not even talk to them anymore. And he said, here's the telephone number of the State Department. If you want to get in touch with us, call us up. Bush announced some sanctions, not very heavy ones, but sanctions, which were essentially called off by Clinton. Bush number two went beyond when his administration ordered Israel not to sell advanced armaments to China, which they really want to do. They're a militarized state, that's a great market. They refused, and Bush administration not only compelled them not to do it, but went out of their way to humiliate them publicly. They would not allow Israeli officials to come to Washington. They insisted on an official apology. They said, we're not going to take that stuff from you guys. That's nothing like that with Obama. He just genuflects. And they know it. That's what's happening here. Right now, with regard to the negotiations, the U.S. and Israel are delighted to have them go on, as long as they meet two preconditions, crucial preconditions. One is that they're under U.S. control. The U.S. has to control the whole region, so has to keep Europe out, everybody out, so they'll run the negotiations, which guarantees that they'll get nowhere. And the second precondition is that Israel must be permitted to continue to build settlements. I won't describe what this means, but if you look at a map, you can figure it out. Those are clear preconditions. No negotiations can continue until those are met. This is described differently in US media and commentary. What's claimed is the Palestinians are imposing preconditions, namely that there be real negotiations and that Israel should stop building settlements. Well, you can look at it that way if you want, but a more accurate way, if you grant that Palestinians are people, is that it's the U.S. and Israel which are imposing strict preconditions designed to ensure that absolutely nothing will happen. Kind of in disgust over the pointlessness of this farcical process, the Palestinian Authority decided to go to the United Nations. Israel was actually deeply concerned about this. This was called a forthcoming tsunami. There was an interesting meeting of the Israeli oligarchs, you know, a dozen or so people who pretty much own the place, a secret meeting, which was naturally leaked. It was published in the Israeli Hebrew press. I don't think it appeared in English. But it was interesting. I mean, the oligarchs were pretty upset. They said, if the Palestinians are recognized by the United Nations, we're going to go into what they called a program of what they called South Africanization. Longshoremen will stop loading ships, countries will boycott our goods, officials won't come here, we'll end up like South Africa. And they don't like that. After all, they own the place. They don't want it to go down the tube. So they urged Prime Minister Netanyahu essentially to accept the international consensus. What they referred to explicitly was a particular version of it, the so-called Geneva Accord, you know, informally negotiated between high-level Palestinian and Israelis, released in December 2003, I think, boycotted by Israel. The U.S. didn't pay any attention at all. Accepted by the rest of the world as usual, you know, representatives from Europe came to applaud it and so on. It's kind of like the Taba close outcome, roughly in line with the international consensus. You can argue about this and that, but somewhere in that region. So they asked they urged Netanyahu to accept it, but he understands the United States very well, so he simply dismissed it. Then comes the UN episode. It's basically the U.S. versus the world, as usual. Most of the world, almost the entire world, supports a Palestinian statehood. In fact, has always recognized Palestine. U.S., of course, objects and says it will veto anything at the Security Council. Crucial question is what Europe will do. Will Europe have the integrity to take a mildly independent stance, or will it just bow before the master, as it usually does? And that's what Europe decided to do. It decided to go along with the master. To make it even more evident, they selected the utterly pathetic Tony Blair to deliver the message to the Palestinians, saying, you guys are unpeople, forget it, go back to the US-run negotiations. The Palestinian Authority had the dignity to say that they're not even going to talk to Blair anymore correctly. But anyway, that essentially killed the UN initiative. Well, meanwhile, the West Bank is being broken up essentially in accord with what used to be called the Sharon Plan. Israel takes over everything behind they call it security wall, the annexation wall, which is important. It is taking over the Jordan Valley. And for those of you who want the details of that, there's a very good report that just came out from B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights group, which gives details in the Jordan Valley of sinking of wells, setting up regions where Palestinians are not allowed, and so on. And what you can see is just taking over the Jordan Valley. That imprisons what's left, and what's left is cantonized, salients running through it, three of them breaking it up into unviable units. Israel has finally understood what imperial powers long ago knew, that it's good to buy off the elites. So maybe not everybody should live like dogs, as Dayan said. Those in Ramallah, the elites, they should have nice restaurants, Shakespeare plays, that sort of thing, just like any third world country, any colony that you go to. And we'll keep them quiet, and then what happens elsewhere is they'll live like dogs, and of course Gaza will be destroyed. Well, that's where it stands now. What are the options? Here I think there's some misunderstanding, and it's worth clarifying. I think there are basically two options. One option is this will continue. The other option is a two-state settlement. Now, when this is discussed, including by Palestinian intellectuals and even Palestinian officials and others, what they say is, there's another option, namely, we'll let Israel take over everything, and then we'll have an anti-apartheid struggle, civil rights struggle. But there isn't the slightest reason to think that's ever going to happen. Israel doesn't want to take over everything. This is not like South Africa, where the apartheid government needed the black population. It's its workforce. They couldn't just cast them loose. Israel doesn't need the Palestinians. In fact, doesn't want them. Dayan's proposal statement was correct. So they'll never take it all over. They'll continue to develop a very intricate program, very carefully organized program of infrastructure development, expansion, so on, take all the valuable resources, the valuable land, the nice suburbs of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, which are up in the hills on the West Bank, take over the Jordan Valley, and let the rest rot, except for Ramallah, where they can have restaurants. They'll never, so there won't be any anti-apartheid struggle. There won't be any demographic problem, a fancy name for too many non-Jews in a Jewish state. That won't happen. So that's just not an option, and there's no point thinking about it. If you're opposed to a two-state settlement at this point, you're essentially telling the Palestinians, get lost, because it doesn't offer them anything. And I think that's worth thinking about. Shouldn't have illusions. Well, a final comment about this. I mean, there are lots of problems all over the world. A lot of them, it's very hard even to imagine a solution. Sort of trying to work out a solution to, say, Kashmir is pretty hard. But of all the problems in the world, this has got to be the easiest one to solve. There's an overwhelming international consensus, there has been pretty much for 35 years, on a political settlement. You know, you can argue about the details, but the basic form is very well known. There's one barrier, the United States won't allow it. And the United States, most powerful state in the world, so what it says goes. But if U.S. rejectionism can shift, and it could, the situation would be quite different. In fact, there'd be nothing much to block a move towards a political settlement. Not a very pretty one, in my opinion. In fact, I don't like it at all. But of the immediate short-term options, the best one that I can think of, and maybe an opening towards further developments later, maybe better ones. But as far as I can see, those are the alternatives. And for us, I think that's kind of an optimistic conclusion, because it means that the future is actually in our hands if we decide to use the power we have. Thanks. Okay.
Okay, we have time now for some questions. There's no line over there, so we'll start over here. Okay.
Hello, Dr. Chomsky. It was a pleasure hearing you speak. My question is, you've clearly denounced U.S. and Israeli aggression, or state-sponsored terrorism, as you'd call it, towards Palestine. However, you've expressed support for Hezbollah, and you were even greeted warmly by them in the year 2006. So my question is, how would you explain this double standard? And if this is not a double standard, then how would you justify that? Thank you.
I actually don't hear very well, especially through a mic, so I need a translator. But my translator isn't here either.
For some reason, it's very hard to understand up here on stage. Pardon me? These mics are bad too? Try it again, a little slower, maybe a little louder.
Okay. Well. Yeah, like I said, Dr. Chomsky, it was a pleasure hearing you speak. However, you've denounced U.S. and Israeli aggression towards Palestine, which you call state-sponsored terrorism. However, in the year 2006, you were greeted warmly by Hezbollah on a visit to Lebanon. And you've also expressed your support towards Hezbollah. And during this visit in the year 2006, you expressed your support for them keeping their arms. And I believe in 2 months later, they attacked Israel. So how would you, if this is not a double standard, then how would you justify this?
I think, are you asking about Hezbollah? Yeah, so let's take Hezbollah. Hezbollah's, the U.S. doesn't want to admit it, Hezbollah's the major political force in Lebanon. There were elections in Lebanon, I think, a year ago. And if you read Thomas Friedman, he practically wept with joy. He said he just loves free elections, makes him his heart melt. And what was so great about this election was that Obama won over Ahmadinejad. Well, in fact, the Hezbollah-based coalition won about 54% of the votes, the same as Obama's victory in the last election. But the system in Lebanon is skewed by an old French imperial system that was imposed that grants confessional representation. And the Shiites, who are the poorest part of the population, they don't get anywhere near their proper representation. So even though the Hezbollah-based coalition handily won the election, they didn't have the majority of representatives. And Nasrallah, you know, he said, accepted that without any comment. So they are, in fact, they and their allies are the major political force. What about their position on use of force? Well, you know, here there's several questions that have to be asked. One is, does Lebanon have a right to defend itself from Israeli attacks? Actually, Israel's invaded 5 times in the last roughly 30 years. So does Lebanon have a right to defend itself? I mean, if they don't, okay, then the argument's over. Let's suppose they do have a right, suppose they're people, not unpeople. Well, the Lebanese army can't defend them. For one thing, it's totally infiltrated by Israel. You know, the U.S. has a heavy control over it. So they can't, and everyone knows they can't defend Lebanon. There's only one force that can defend Lebanon, namely Hezbollah. And they've done it pretty successfully. It's one of the reasons they're so hated in Israel and the United States. They finally drove, after years, they drove Israel out of its illegal occupation of southern Lebanon, year 2000. And when Israel attacked in 2006, they fought quite a surprising defensive battle, and Israel was pretty well bloodied. They had to pull out without achieving their objectives. And there's no other force that can do it. So, and while you say that Hezbollah attacked Israel, that's kind of a little misleading. Israel finally withdrew in the year 2000. In the following years, there was no Hezbollah provocation at all, even though Israel was constantly violating the border, kidnapping people in Lebanon, bringing them to Israel, putting them in prison, and killing them sometimes. In fact, you read one of Israel's leading strategic analysts, Zev Maoz. He wrote an article after the 2006 war, and the title was something like Border Violation is Border Violation. He said, yeah, Hezbollah violated the border, but in fact, we do it all the time, so we can't say anything about that. In U.S.-Israeli propaganda, it's called a Hezbollah attack. Okay, maybe they should have done it, maybe they shouldn't. In fact, when they did it, it was with the support of the majority of the population. They wanted to capture Israeli soldiers at the border and use them in a prisoner exchange. Well, there are lots of Lebanese and Palestinian prisoners in Israel, Lebanese too. So, okay, maybe right, maybe wrong, but it's a little, you can't call it aggression, especially when you look at it in the context. Now, you can like Hezbollah or not, that's a separate question. But I think these are the basic relevant facts about it.
Over here.
Hello. Thanks again for coming. Can you hear me in this? Is that okay? Thank you for coming to speak tonight. So my question for you is, so in a two-state solution, and there may not be an exact answer, but just in your opinion, in a two-state solution, what would Israel do with 500,000 settlers? And that is, should they be removed, or what exactly is your take on that?
In your opinion, what? What came after that?
You got the important part.
Can you hear me now? Is that better? Okay. In a two-state solution, what would Israel do with 500,000 settlers?
In a two-state solution, what would Israel do with the
settlers? Let me just go back and say one more word about the preceding question, because there's an interesting fact about it, which is known to people who read the Hebrew press, but isn't acknowledged here. One of the main prisoner that Hezbollah wanted released is Samir Kuntar, who's a little bit like Omer Khadr. I think he was a 15-year-old boy, I think, who was Lebanese, who was accused of a really brutal murder, killing a 2-year-old Israeli girl. Well, maybe that's right, or maybe not. His Israeli interrogator, the guy who interrogated him, you know, from the Shin Bet, says he's innocent. He didn't do it, you know, he's convinced, so we can put that aside. What would happen to the settlers? Well, I know what my feeling is, and what the two sides would decide is up to them. But my feeling is that Israel should offer to evacuate settlers back to Israel. It should give them inducements to leave their government-subsidized homes, because remember, they're heavily subsidized. to move into the occupied territories. It would say, okay, leave your subsidized homes in the West Bank, and we'll give you subsidized homes in Israel. My guess is that probably 95% of the settlers would leave. If there are a few Orthodox Jews from Brooklyn who want to hang on to every rock, they should be allowed to stay in a Palestinian state. But that's my opinion.
Yeah. Over here. Over here, please.
Mr. Chomsky, you mentioned that negotiations under U.S. control would have specific preconditions, according to some evidence on your part. However, at the United Nations just a few weeks ago, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu stood up and called on direct negotiations here in New York without preconditions. Mahmoud Abbas said no. What is your comment on that?
Because exactly what I said. Netanyahu imposed two crucial conditions. The negotiations have to be under U.S. control. That means the world's leading rejectionist power will have to be the negotiator. Okay, that kills him right away. And crucially, he insisted on a very important precondition. Israel must be allowed to increase its illegal settlements, which are tearing the place to shreds. And of course, everyone, including him, knows that as long as the negotiations go on under U.S. control, they'll go on forever. And meanwhile, Israel will take what it wants. So yeah, he stood up and he announced those crucial preconditions, which in the U.S. are interpreted differently. Because remember, we don't consider the Palestinians to be people, they're unpeople. So therefore, we interpret it, you read the press here, as Palestinian preconditions. That's not what it is. He's imposing. it's really, you know, quite straightforward. The two issues are, should the U.S. run them, which guarantees that nothing will happen, and should Israel be permitted to continue its illegal settlement programs, which are indisputably illegal, which will essentially give it what it wants. Those are the preconditions.
This last question was an excellent model for how to ask your questions slowly and enunciate.
Yeah, actually, if they don't come too close to the mic, I think it's better.
And it may be better not to come too close to the mic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's going to be a tough act to follow. Okay. Good evening, Professor Chomsky. Can you explain what is meant by a binational state? And if the two-state settlement that you talked about, the one based on the international consensus, if that goes through, would that be a precursor to an ultimate binational state, or would that be an ultimate end in and of itself?
Afraid I didn't get it.
No. I think you heard
it. Oh, a binational state.
But whether the plan you're talking about is then a precursor to that.
To a binational. Well, I mean, I've been in favor of a binational state all my life. Actually, not even in favor of that. I don't see any particular reason for worshiping the imperial imposed borders. I happened to live in Israel with my wife about 60 years ago, and we were, you know, students, backpacking around and so on. We happened to cross the Lebanese border. It wasn't marked, you know. There's no mark. It's just the Galilee, you know, arbitrarily broken in two by Britain and France for their own imperial reasons. Why should, you know, maybe you have to accept them? Why should we regard them as holy? So short of that, it's not a small point, if you do worship the borders, then I think a binational state is a much better solution. Back in the 1940s, I was a Zionist youth leader, but opposed to a Jewish state. in favor of a binational state based on Arab-Jewish working class cooperation. I still think that's the best idea, but I only know of one way to get there at all that's even possible, and that's in stages. If there's another way, I'd like to hear about it. But I mean, I hear a lot of people talk about one state, which means binational state, because there's two national groups. But just saying I want one state is like saying I want peace in the world. Doesn't mean anything till you tell me how you go from here to there. And I've only heard one proposal, that you move to the international consensus, which essentially everybody accepts outside the United States and Israel. And once that's established, my guess is that the people themselves will see that it doesn't make any sense. Anyone who's traveled in that region or lived there knows that there's simply no sensible way to draw a line through Cisjordan that makes any sense at all. So I assume that what would happen is the cycle of violence would reduce, relations would begin in normal ways to be established, commercial, cultural, others. In fact, it's already happening, across the border with Jordan. And when that continues, at some point, there'll be a recognition that should move towards something like maybe federalism. And from federalism, you can move on to something closer if the two sides see that there's a better way to live. And in the longer term, my feeling is the people in that whole region, given if they're not blocked by imperial power, will move towards something like kind of an Ottoman system. Now, nobody wants the Ottoman Empire back, it's brutality, corruption, and everything else. But they had the right idea about something. They left people alone, partly because they were too corrupt to do anything about it. But they left people alone, so you go to Beirut or Jerusalem, wherever it is, the Armenians run their affairs, and the Greeks run their affairs, and the Jews run their affairs. There weren't many of them. And they sort of interact. It was kind of a pretty friendly. You could travel from Cairo to Baghdad to Constantinople without ever crossing a border. And there were plenty of connections. And for that region, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think it makes a lot of sense for almost every region, but that's another story. And I think maybe it could move on to that. I mean, if there's some other plan, I'd like to hear it. But the only other thing I hear is slogans.
Over here.
Mr. Chomsky. In 2007, at Camp David, in 2000, at Camp David, under Clinton's direction, Ehud Barak offered 97% of the West Bank and 100% of the Gaza Strip, and Arafat turned his head and walked away from the negotiations. What ensued was the second intifada and years of Hamas and Palestinian terrorism targeted against Israel. How can you fallaciously claim that it was Barak that walked away from the negotiations when it was in fact Yasser Arafat who turned around?
You're talking about the Camp David agreements in 2000?
Yes.
Yeah. We really don't have to discuss that because Clinton himself recognized that they made no sense. In fact, you can look it up if you want, but what I said is easily documented. It's all in print. The Camp David negotiations were in the summer. The standard tale here is what you said, but a couple of months later, Clinton recognized that no Palestinian, no Arab is ever going to accept the terms that he and Barak tried to impose. He recognized they made no sense. He presented his parameters in December, and just as I said, he gave a speech in which he said both sides have accepted them, they have reservations, they'll meet to work out their reservations, and then followed what I described. So there's no need to discuss it. There really isn't. I mean, there is an official story, it's true, but like a lot of official stories, it falls apart very quickly as soon as you look at the facts.
Over here.
Maybe I don't know enough about the relationship between the United States and Israel, but why, in your opinion, why do you think the U.S. has been allowing Israel to allow these war crimes and to become, you know, just to be almost voiceless about what's going on, even though they're very much aware that terrible things are happening and there's so much injustice currently?
I'm sorry.
Why do you think that U.S. allows, why do you think the U.S. is on the side of Israel and allows them to?
So why does the U.S. support these criminal actions in the West Bank and Gaza and so on? Well, I mean, part of the reason is pretty simple. Israeli Jews are people. Palestinians are unpeople. And you treat people and unpeople quite differently. But then there are serious reasons, too. Israel offers a lot to the United States. Palestine offers them nothing. Palestinians have no force. They have no wealth. They don't have powerful support, so they don't have any human rights. I mean, it's an elementary principle of statecraft. Israel, on the other hand, is a rich, advanced, technologically advanced, highly militarized society. It provides, it has very close strategic and intelligence relations with the U.S. In fact, if you look back at the history, U.S.-Israeli relations were established in their current form in 1967, and something happened in 1967. There was, you know, we know that there was an Israeli-Arab war, but there was more than that. At that time, there was a war going on between Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and it was an actual war. It was fought in Yemen, mostly proxy war, but it was real. And what lay behind it was a serious conflict between secular nationalism based in Egypt and extremist religious fundamentalism based in Saudi Arabia. And the US and the UK have pretty consistently supported extremist fundamentalism, and still do, in fact, and opposed secular nationalism. And there's good reasons for that. Secular nationalism threatens, whether we'll do it or not, to take over the resources of the region and use them for the benefit of its people. The religious extremist fundamentalism, they'll work for whoever will, you know, let them play their games and get wealthy. There's incidentally very good historical work on this for both Britain and the United States, if you want the documentation. But it's pretty consistent, and it continues today. Well, this conflict was going on, Israel succeeded in destroying the center of Arab secular nationalism, which was in Egypt. And that was a great gift to the United States and to Saudi Arabia, its main ally. And you know, they were impressed. Actually, it's a long history, but that made a change. And that's when the relations were established in their current form. And then it continued. So in 1970, for example, Jordan, there was a Palestinian uprising in Jordan, and it looked for a while as if Syria might intervene to prevent the Palestinians from being massacred. The United States didn't like that. At the time, the United States was so bogged down in Southeast Asia that it couldn't possibly do anything. So it called on Israel. Israel mobilized, you know, has a very powerful military force. Syria backed down. And that was considered another gift to Saudi Arabia. They were concerned that Saudi Arabia might be threatened by a nationalist uprising in Jordan. A lot of conflict between the two. And at that time, the Nixon Doctrine was established. This was called the Nixon Doctrine, was that, of course, the main concern in the Middle East is the energy reserves. That goes way back to the Second World War, even before. The main concern is the energy reserves, mostly in Saudi Arabia, safely under the control of Islamic religious extremists who do what we like. and we got to keep it that way. But then somebody has to protect the dictators who we support from their own populations. And so there have to be what the Nixon administration called cops on the beat, the local gendarmes, preferably non-Arab, because they do a better job killing Arabs. And then police headquarters, of course, is in Washington, a branch office in London. So that's the basic structure. And at the time, the cops on the beat were Iran, non-Arab, under the Shah, who was a loyal ally and a dictator, Pakistan, which provided the Saudi Royal Guard and so on, a lot of Pakistani mercenaries working in Saudi Arabia, Turkey, non-Arab, big military force, and now Israel was added to it. So Israel's another cop on the beat, and a very useful one. And it sort of continues like this. I go through the record if you like, but there continue to be very close military and intelligence relations. The United States uses Israel to pre-position weapons. Israel can, in fact, carry out experiments with advanced weapons on live targets, which is useful. You try out your new weapons that way. And all sorts of, and also Israel, by the 1980s, it was becoming, Congress was imposing constraints on support for our most vicious clients. So you needed surrogates who would move in and do it. Taiwan, Israel, British intelligence, contractors and others. But Israel played a big role in that kind of secondary services. So that's one category. Another category is strict economic. U.S. investment in Israel high-tech industry is increasing pretty quickly, and it's a close relationship. Israel has a highly militarized high-tech economy. In fact, if you look at one of the interesting WikiLeaks exposures, listed vital regions of the world which are of high strategic importance to the United States must be protected at all odds. There weren't a lot of them. One of them was right near Haifa, Rafael Military Industries, and one of the places where they developed drones and other high-tech weapons. And that's considered just part of the United States. In fact, Rafael, it's a big military industry, actually moved their management to Washington because they're closer to the Pentagon and the funders and so on. A very close integration. Intel, which is the biggest chip company in the world, they have a new generation of chips coming along, which they think will sweep the market. They're building their main factory in Israel, and a lot of other connections like that. And that's a natural. On the other hand, again, the Palestinians offer absolutely nothing. There are other factors, which I think are probably underestimated, cultural factors. There's a structure in the world that political scientists sometimes call the Anglosphere, England and its offshoots. Offshoots are the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. The Anglosphere is somewhat unusual in the history of imperialism. In the Anglosphere, the English settlers exterminated the native population and replace them. That's not the usual course of imperialism. And that's deeply embedded in the culture of the Anglosphere. We did it, so it's got to be right. And the Jews are doing it, so it's got to be right. And if you look at international diplomacy, about the only countries, that big countries that sometimes go along with the United States, the Marshall Islands do and so on, but real countries, are Australia and increasingly Canada. They, I think, just sense a kind of commonality. And this is reinforced by something else. The Anglosphere is unusually religious. Deeply religious. These are fundamentalist societies, particularly the United States. The United States is one of the most extreme fundamentalist societies in the world. About a third of the population believes in the literal truth of the Bible. I doubt that there's another country in the world that comes close to that. And about half the population thinks the world was created a couple thousand years ago, because that's what it says in their interpretation of the Bible. About two-thirds of the population is expecting the second coming. Some of them, like Rick Perry, expected in our lifetime. These are extremely unusual things. Well, and in fact, it's not, you know, we think about it sometimes as, you know, uneducated people in rural Texas. It's not, it's the elites. Lord Balfour, you know, Christian Zionism in England long preceded Jewish Zionism, and it was the elites. You know, Lord Balfour, Lloyd George, and these guys. In the United States, when General Allenby conquered Jerusalem during the First World War, you take a look at the headlines in the national press. Richard the Lionhearted defeated Saladin. We won the Crusades, literally. He saved the Jerusalem from the pagans. Well, the Bible says something else. The next thing that has to happen is Jews have to go back to Israel. Even in the Roosevelt administration, Harold Ickes, you know, major person, said that the return of the Jews to Palestine is the most important event in human history. And if you're a Bible-reading fanatic, yeah, you could believe that. And this permeates large parts of American culture, from elites down to evangelicals. When you get to people like, say, Bush number two, you know, evangelical extremist and others, well, it takes on a different form. That's real, and that, I think, reinforces the general sense that there's got to be something right about the Jews kicking out the Palestinians, because it's pretty much what we did. And in fact, if you look back over the history, the analogy of Jews in Palestine to the United States and Red Indians runs all the way through. You find it all over the place. I don't know how much weight to put on these factors, but I think they're significant cultural factors, along with very clear strategic, intelligence, military, economic factors. It could be changed. I mean, if significant parts of the real U.S. power system decided to shift, it would shift. And incidentally, there are signs of that, interesting signs of that. If you read closely stuff that's coming out in, you know, from military leaders, high intelligence officials, even the Centers of Strategic Planning, like the CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Strategy, one of these, you know, conservative think tanks concerned with military, they're beginning to raise questions about whether the strategic analysis, the strategic alliance with Israel really makes sense at this point. I'm sure you saw a statement by General Petraeus, the head of the Strategic Command, Central Command for the region. He, a couple of years ago, said that Israel's intransigence is harming our brave boys and girls, you know, fighting out in the fields. He was immediately shut up, but he was expressing a view that is expressed by others. If that ever broke through, I think you would see a wave of anti-Semitism in the United States that would be fierce. You know, these Jews are harming our brave boys and girls, and I'm not going to accept that. And it might shift American policy radically. It wouldn't be very pretty, and I don't want to see it change that way, but it could happen. Other things could happen too, but if you just consider the balance of force and power and wealth between Israel and the Palestinians, what's happening kind of almost follows like a theorem.
Over here.
Thank you.
Hello. Is this fine? Okay. How has the language surrounding unpeoples evolved since the genesis of the State of Israel to contemporary times? And how can the Palestinians distinguish themselves as peoples?
Well, the actual term is more recent. It's, as far as I know, not before Mark Curtis, who used it a couple of years ago in his books on the British imperial crimes. But it's the concept is there, you know, and it goes way back. I mean, that's the way we treat the native population here. You know, they're unpeopled. You kill them, exterminate them, break treaties, steal their land. The African-American population is kind of obvious. In fact, the Constitution says they're three-fifths human, they're unpeopled. As I mentioned, the 14th Amendment was supposed to remedy that in the Civil War, but it really didn't, just for a couple of years, and it went right back to the same thing with criminalization and so on. And we're right in the middle of it now. And the it's just a standard imperial concept. Actually, it's a pretty interesting history. If you look at the, I don't know if we should go into this, but if you look at the intellectual history, it's kind of interesting. In the 17th century in England and France, main imperial powers, there was a lot of concern. They were discovering lots of new creatures, you know, expanding beyond Europe. And you get these blacks, orangutans, a lot of others. And there's a lot of discussion about which ones are people and should have rights and which ones aren't people. And especially if you were a Cartesian, that was pretty crucial, because there's for a Cartesian, there's a sharp distinction between creatures who have a soul and those who don't. Now, the ones who have a soul are people. The ones who don't are not people. They're machines, in fact. Long story behind that. So a lot of debates. And they were kind of, trying to figure out who's, I mean, they kind of look the same. They're not European, so how do we decide? There's some very interesting discussions. A lot of it had to do with, one of my favorite arguments was by Louis Racine, the son of the dramatist. He concluded that apes are actually smarter than us. And the proof is they don't use language. And the reason behind it is that they understand that if they used language, we would enslave them, like we enslave the blacks. Maybe. You could add that to the literature on teaching apes language. They're smart enough not to do it, you know. But it was a serious issue right through the early days of imperialism, and then it kind of goes on, you know.
Over here.
Professor Chomsky, what are your thoughts about the recent diplomatic tension between Israel and Turkey about the Mavi Marmara event and the UN report, and Turkey's role in the region regarding the peace process?
What are your views about the relation between Turkey and Israel and the recent events?
Well, Turkey and Israel have been very close allies since 1958. It was kind of secret at the time, you know, known but not discussed. But in 1958, Ben-Gurion made, you know, agreements with Turkey, and they've been very close allies since. This continued right through the Nixon doctrine period. Military relations, economic relations, they couldn't have much in the way of public diplomatic relations, because, you know, have to look. It didn't fit with the image, but they continued. In fact, it was Israel's only regional ally, and an important one. Well, last couple of years, that's in fact declined. Prime Minister Erdogan has taken pretty strong stands against Israeli crimes. During the Gaza attack, he was about the only Western sort of quasi-Western, if you like, leader, who actually came out very strongly denouncing the crimes. The West mostly accepted them. Then came the Mavi Marmara incident, where Israel attacked a ship in international waters. It's called hijacking when Somalis do it. And it happened to be a Turkish ship. Not technically, it was essentially a Turkish ship. They attacked the ship in international waters and killed 9 Turks, one of them American citizen. And Turkey didn't like that. And that made relations much worse. Israel was quite surprised by this reaction, and with good reason. I mean, Israel had been hijacking ships in international waters for decades. I mean, it goes back to the 70s. You know, the ships going between Cyprus and Lebanon, Israel would attack them, capture, kill people, kidnap people, bring them to prisons in Israel. And nobody ever made a fuss about it because the U.S. was saying, fine. And they didn't quite understand why all of a sudden it's an issue. But it did become an issue, and it's now gone beyond. I mean, practically, Israel has reacted in a... Israel's gone way to the right, you have to understand. I mean, it was 10 years ago, I think they would have smoothed it over. But Israel went way out of its way to make the relations worse. So the foreign minister in Israel, foreign minister, Dani Aiello, sub-foreign, what is he? He was foreign minister, yeah. He called in the, he was a deputy foreign minister, I think, yeah. He called in the Turkish ambassador and set up a kind of a televised scene in which he was sitting on a high chair and the Turkish ambassador sitting on a low stool, and it was all televised, and he's kind of lecturing him. That's just not done in diplomatic relations. And Turkey didn't like it a bit, And there are things going on like that. And it's gotten pretty tense by now. I mean, Turkey has stated that they're, I don't know if they'll do it, that they'll send naval vessels to accompany ships trying to break the Gaza siege, like the flotilla. If that happened, I don't know what would happen. We'd go to war. Just recently, there was an announcement, I don't know if it's true, that Israeli planes were scrambling in Turkish airspace to harass Turkish vessels that are exploring for natural gas. That's a big conflict brewing all through the region. There's been a lot of natural gas discoveries in that whole region, and everybody wants a piece of them, and a lot of conflicts. And one of them is Turkey and Israel. Turkey complained about it. I don't know if it's true. It was just reported on, in the press. But if that kind of thing goes on, there could be serious conflicts.
Thank you.
Over here.
Hi, Professor Chomsky. Just want to thank you for doing what you do. And considering the global protesting going on, especially this past Saturday, and even in New York City, do you think a people's movement can start in Israel to challenge these policies? And if so, how would the U.S. react to that? Thank you.
Can a people's movement start in Israel to challenge these problems?
Well, I mean, there has been a pretty interesting kind of Occupy movement in Israel. It's relative to population, it's probably the biggest one in the world. They have pretty narrow goals. Understandable, but narrow. It's pretty, reasonably privileged people, people like you, basically. Students, relatively well-off families who are being squeezed hard by the neoliberal policies. So they can't get apartments, they gotta live in their parents' homes, can't get decent jobs, and same thing's happening all over the West. And they protested about that. It excluded, by decision, anything related to the occupation. So it didn't mention that. The reasoning apparently was if they brought it up, it would just undermine it. Israeli Arabs apparently didn't participate. They're the most repressed group in Israel, along with Orthodox Jews, who also live in poverty. I don't think they participated. So it was kind of relatively affluent, educated uprising, and a pretty serious one, but for narrow goals. Could anything go beyond that? It's pretty hard to say. Israel's changed a lot in the last few years, dramatically. It's shifted way to the right. This shows up in diplomacy and a lot of other things. So for example, take the demand that, Netanyahu's demand that the Palestinians recognize Israel as a Jewish state. As far as I know, that's just arisen in the last couple of years. It was never raised before. And it's just a kind of a barrier to ensure that negotiations won't get anywhere. I mean, it's kind of like the notion right to exist, which as far as I know arose in the 70s after steps were being taken to accept the right to exist in peace and security. You know, the wording of UN 242, got to raise the barrier to prevent, I mean, no country has a right to, no state has a right to exist. Like Mexico recognizes the United States, but it doesn't recognize its right to exist on half of Mexico, conquered by aggression. You know, as far as a Jewish state is concerned, you know, Obama recognizes it, but no sane politician, say, recognizes Pakistan as an Islamic state. That's what they call themselves. So we recognize Pakistan, but we don't recognize Pakistan as an Islamic state. You know, we just recognize Pakistan. Same with, you know, Saudi Arabia, which is extreme. But so this is a new demand, and it's a reflection of the general shift to the right, which is very noticeable. So whether anything can, I mean, in Israel, amazingly, they do not, you know, overwhelmingly, I don't know the figures, but it's very high, do not understand why the world was outraged by the Gaza attack. They don't understand why the world was outraged by the Mavi Marmara. In fact, the standard picture in Israel, you know, aside from the fringes, is our brave soldiers were attacked by the people on the ship. I mean, that's their conception. Overwhelmingly. They're kind of circling the wagons. It has a certain resemblance to South Africa. There's some interesting comparisons. There's a lot of comparisons drawn with South Africa. Most of them don't make any sense. But there's some that are very, I think, meaningful. I'll mention one. Around 1960, the apartheid regime understood that they're beginning to be recognized as an international pariah. And in fact, in I think 1960 or so, the foreign minister called in the American ambassador and told him, we have the documents have been declassified, that we understand we're a pariah state, everyone votes against us in the United Nations. But you and I know that there's only one vote in the United Nations, yours, and as long as you support us, we don't give a damn what the rest of the world thinks. And that's exactly the way it developed. By the 1970s, the UN imposed an embargo. And by the 1980s, the US Congress imposed sanctions. The Reagan administration continued to support South Africa. As part of their global war on terror. In fact, in 1988, the Reagan administration declared that the African National Congress, Mandela's Congress, was one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. So you had to defend the white regime against them. And that was not a small thing that led to millions of deaths, literally. And that continued until about 1988. Meanwhile, South Africa was acting more and more what looks like irrationally. I mean, they were carrying out major atrocities, just kind of kicking the world in the face, you know, attacking refugee camps for no reason, killing hundreds of people. And the white regime thought as long as they got the United States behind them, it just doesn't matter what the rest of the world thinks, which turned out to be right. Around 1990, for reasons that we can only surmise, there's no documentary record, the United States changed its position suddenly. And that was the end of apartheid. Within a couple of years, it was formally gone. I think you can guess the reasons, but we don't really have documentary evidence. And I think Israel's following the same course and treading on pretty thin ice.
It's my job to, is this on? It's my job to make sure Professor Chomsky gets to his flight on time. And in order to do that, we have to leave right at 7:45. So I'm very sorry to the people who wanted to ask questions but couldn't, but we need to stop here and thank Professor Chomsky.